Open VoIP 929-299-1269.
Welcome to the SDF conferencing system. One other party is in this conference.
From the depths of Lake Michigan, remote viewing from Chicago's northwest side, this is Vintage Cop. With Jazz Maz, exclusively on Anon Radio. Now, here's Jazz.
There are two other parties in this conference.
Hello, this is Jazz Maz on, I guess, Vintage Comp tonight. And Vintage Comp is heard on OpenVOIP on AnonRadio.net from 0200 to 0300 hours UTC, technically on Saturdays. I don't frequently get a chance to get on here, but I figured I would get on for at least a little while tonight and remind everyone that this weekend is the Interim Computer Festival in Seattle, Wisconsin. You can visit sdf.org/ICF for more details. I believe it is being hosted in the Interspace in, I think it's Intraspace, near the Rainier Brewery in Seattle, Washington. But do give the site a look because it has a listing of exhibits that are going to be there. SDF, of course, will have a exhibit there that will be probably some terminals and some computers. It looks like there is a new PyDP 10 kit, which is sort of a PDP 10 emulator with a sort of faithfully reproduced front panel control. If you go to mastodon.sdf.org /@SDF and scroll down a few posts, you'll see a picture of it. It's kind of cool. And, of course, the online systems at SDF will probably be connected to the SDF exhibit. So if you want to... if you can't make it physically there in Seattle, but you'd like to participate, you can sign into any number of the systems, a few of which that I can recall are, SDF's TwinX.org project, which is a PDP-10. I believe the one that it's connected to, but it could be different now because of the show, is the XKL Toad 2, I think is normally what that is connected to, and that's TwinEx.org, I believe. You can easily sign up for credentials for that. And there might also be, a tourist account setting that you can kind of just go in there, and so long as you behave, you can go in there and kind of look around. And let me think, what else is there? Of course, there is the PIDP 8 system that has been running for quite some time. But SDF, I think that's running the timeshare system 8 operating system. So it's time sharing on a Raspberry Pi emulating a PDP 8. And I think that can be accessed by, or you can find more information about that at, I think, tss8.sdf.org. What else? Occasionally the SDF AT&T 3B2500 comes out of retirement for a weekend for events such as these. We'll see what happens. And I think, you know, that might be 3b2.sdf.org, or I think it used to be, when it was online, you could SSH to 3b2@sdf.org to get at it. Let's see here. And then, of course, there is the Unix 50 project, unix50.org, which is, you know, once again, emulated systems that you can kind of create and destroy upon demand. Who else am I forgetting? I think we have I think we have an ITS example of PDP-10 systems. I'm trying to think where that is. That is, I think that's hackturn.org, and I think it's spelled hacktrn.org, although I think it might be pronounced hacktron. You know, I just want to run it together like a terrible American, but I believe it might be pronounced hacktron, hacktrn.org, for the ITS incompatible time sharing system, which was, you know, one of many time-sharing systems created for the PDP-10 hardware. And I'm sure there will be people on all of these over, you know, on and off over the weekend, so lurk early, lurk often. Trying to think if there's anything else that I am overlooking that could be of interest. I guess I'll take a walk over to my computer and see if anyone is making any comments in Commode chat. You know, sometimes this slot is not exactly always listen to, because it is normally a block of silence most of the time, but occasionally people will pay attention and respond. Oh yes, we are getting some comments. Blinking lights on the PDP were the best part. Yeah, if you were in actually anywhere near the front panel, like PDP-10, I don't know how many people would have had access to a front panel. I certainly wouldn't back in the day when they were commonplace. I guess if you were at a major university that had one running still. INIQ 8827 says that there is a guy that we might like called Moshix, who's someone who has a YouTube channel that is completely about old IBM Big Iron. Yeah, so oh, Scott. got in, says, oh, 3b2 at sdf.org. He was trying 3b2.sdf.org yesterday. Yeah, you never know if it's going to be online or not. I know that systems can be somewhat temperamental. And also, since SMJ is kind of running the show at the Interim Computer Museum for the Interim Computer Festival, his hands are probably full. I know on their schedule, they're still, in exhibitor setup mode right now. And even if that winds up completing early, I assume people are going to dinner at some point. And maybe getting some sleep. Quinton just shared a link in combo chat about the PyDP10 case. Anyone is paying attention there and wants to go and find out more. Well, the problem with the reason why emulators and these sort of somewhat faithful front panel computers are interesting is one that you can kind of simulate, toggling in the bootstrap loader as operators once had to, if you want to. You can also automate and, just bootstrap it automatically. But the other more important thing is a lot of this, big iron and mini computer hardware simply doesn't exist in large quantities anymore, and what does exist often is not in operable shape. It's, sort of a constant repair project and collecting project. Sometimes you'll find stuff that is incomplete. You might find a PDP-8 chassis that is incomplete or has bad flip chips on it, and you'll have to fix or replace those cards. So at some point in time, there will, be very few of the real iron. And also the other thing is with some of the big iron, it's just not practical to run it for hobby 24/7. And you might, if you have it, you might power it up for special events and for special demonstrations, that sort of thing. But often it requires a lot more maintenance and power requirements are kind of heavy for some of those systems. So you might not want to, a museum, say, might not want to spend their money running something like that 24/7 if they don't have users on it, or they're not doing something useful with it or otherwise interesting to somebody. I forget which systems are. There's also the Living Computers Museum and Labs, I believe, has a number of systems still online. I forget what the URL for that was. I think a lot of them were through, I think there was an SSH account for one of those, either on, I think it was tty.livingcomputers.com. I don't know, I'd have to look it up. Chances are I'll probably post some information later, later tonight or earlier in the morning tomorrow, regarding what resources seem to be online. Quinton is commenting that the link that he had shared about the PyDP10 is a forum post on retrocomputingforum.com. Yeah, that's not one I'm on or read frequently, so maybe I'll have to check that out. usually if they generate an RSS, it's a lot easier to kind of follow that stuff. Or some type of
open VoIP 929-299-1269.
Because I tend to be a list lurker and don't interact a lot on various forums beyond sort of announcements and information. Usually I prefer in person for more of a open discussion. But that's just me. There are clearly plenty of people that like to use whatever forum or messaging systems are out there to talk about this subject matter. And I will remind people that anyone can call in and anyone can talk about what they would like to talk about. The number to call is 929-299-1269 or extension 1088 from your SDF VoiceOver IP account. More information about the telephone system at SDF can be found in the tutorial section at sdf.org. I think what else of interest is going on? Sadly, my personal vintage comp behavior, or I should say activities, have been reorganizing storage this week, spending an hour or two every evening moving stuff around and trying to find things that I've mislaid, and trying to get my storage units in order so that I can close one of the ones that the rent's a little out of control on, and which requires me moving stuff around. So it's always fun when it gets to that point that you know, the cost of rent for the year, the difference in the cost of the rent for a year versus the, you know, couple of hours a day over the course of a week is sort of a wash to sort of reset things back to blow myself up. Keep forgetting I'm making tea and keep forgetting to follow through and complete the process. But yeah, so yeah, a lot of work on and off this week, moving stuff around, recataloging things. I did bring home and set up on my dining room table a couple of classic computer systems. I've got my VIC-20, my TI-99-4A, and color computer, Tandy Radio Shack Color Computer 2 set up on my dining room table. I'm going to probably use them, or at least attempt to use them, for interacting with people at the Intern Computer Festival. Via the classic systems that are online. We'll see how that goes. Yes, got in. C64 was the first computer in our household as well, although before that, I made use of friends' computers. So I had friends that had a VIC-20, so spent a lot of time doing type-in programs as a kid on that when I was over at my friend's place. I had another friend that had an Atari 400, and, you know, sometimes the same in that case, typing in programs, although he had a cassette recorder player for it, so, and a couple of games. So that was nice that we could actually save our work, whereas my friend's who had the VIC-20 didn't have any storage with it. So they had a couple of game cartridges, some of the classic Scott Adams games, I think like The Count and Voodoo Castle. So we used to play those as well. On the 400, my friend had a copy of a game called Scram, which is sort of a nuclear reactor simulator. And then, of course, when you get bored with it, you kill all your workers, shut down all the water, all the water flow, kill all your workers, and pull out the control rods, and let the fun begin. Yeah, the VIC-20 was sort of an interim computer in the Commodore 8-bit line that was targeting, you know, kind of really their first truly affordable home computer. Because the PETs were still quite expensive for, you know, late 1970s, early 1980s dollars, especially if you wanted disk with them. although they did, you know, they did have tape interfaces as well, so that was always an option. But I guess the fact that it came fully integrated computer with monitor made them a little more expensive, whereas the VIC-20, you know, was intended to be hooked to a common television set for a monitor instead, like many of home computers were, to kind of make that less of an expense. I figured most people at that point in time had at least one television in the household and it could be used for the computer. The VIC-20 was somewhat underpowered in the sense that it didn't have much RAM in it, and what RAM it did have, only a small amount was available for actual basic programs. The RAM expansion was somewhat common.
There are three other parties in this conference.
Hello and welcome.
Hello. It's SCM.
Oh, hey, SCM. How are you tonight?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing good. A little tired, but otherwise okay.
Excellent. So you're in Wisconsin, did you say?
No, I'm actually in Chicago.
Okay.
There is a event coming up early next month, first weekend in April, called the Midwest Gaming Classic, which is up in Milwaukee.
Gotcha.
I might go to that. It depends what that weekend looks like for me. That one I can always do a spur of the moment, go up there for a day because it's so close. And I could always, you know, take a bus or jump on a train last minute pretty easily. So what's new and exciting in old computers for you, SCM?
Well, nothing old and exciting right now. Although I would love to get back to writing software for the Amiga,
mm-hmm.
Not the Amiga, I'm sorry, for the Commodore 64,
uh-huh.
Through emulation. That's
sure,
the best.
Sure.
That's the best I can do. I don't have room for old machines, unfortunately. I wish I did.
Yeah, but as far as a classic 64 goes, you don't need a lot of space for it. But
that's true.
The problem is then you need to get a few little extra peripherals to make everything work. Some of that is cheaper and more available now. Like you can get like a micro IEC pretty cheaply, which will emulate disk to a reasonable amount. It's not fully 100% compatible with say, an actual 1541, but it is a convenient mass storage device, and it's, you know, under $100. So. And then, of course, then you need something, you get video on the screen, so you need a capture device or a conversion device.
Yeah, definitely. I know there's sort of this movement for a lot of, I've seen a lot of, like, new 8-bit machines.
Yeah, I have seen quite a lot of that. Like, I've seen single-board computers that, are Z80-based or 6502-based, and they're not necessarily 100% compatible with what came before, but they are similar in the sense that they use an older CPU and essentially have a pretty well-known programming interface to them. You know, the programming interface is published, and it's built out of parts. They're often built out of parts you can still get today.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
6502s probably aren't going away anytime soon because, A, there's a bunch of new old stock that's out there because there were so many, you know, not just a single second source, but many second sources that just, you know, manufactured tons and tons and tons of them. The Western Design Center still exists today, and you can buy those CPUs as well. You know, you can buy yourself essentially a CMOS variant with even NMOS compatible input output on it, for that matter.
Yeah, definitely very interesting, for sure. Yeah. I know that Alan Cox of Linux fame is quite the 8-bit enthusiast.
Yeah, he is kind of well known for Fusix? After the Linux kernel stuff, after he kind of left the kernel development community, I guess he was working on a thin Unix-like operating system designed for small micros, and I guess he wrote a system called Fusix, Fusix? I forget. It's been a while since I've seen it demoed. But I guess one of the targets was the TRS-80 color computer line of computers. And that's actually where I saw it demoed at CocoaFest some years ago.
Oh, that's good to know because it wasn't entirely clear to me what hardware to target if I were to try that out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know it runs on the color computer line of color computers. I don't know if you need a Cocoa 3 specifically or if it'll run on a 2. Because 2s are a lot more commonly available. 3s actually cost real money these days.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah.
Huh. I wonder where... I did have a Coco years ago. And unfortunately, I wasn't able to do much with it. I didn't have a lot of peripherals. But, yeah, I always wondered how easy they were to pick up and for how much.
Yeah, I don't know what 3s are actually going for. I mean, I've bought a couple. I have 2 2s in my collection. One I got for probably nothing, but it's a little bit of a SCSI. And I don't mean peripheral interface SCSI. I mean kind of, you know, yellowed and has stickers on it and isn't a really good, clean example, but it does work.
Yeah,
and then I've got a slightly better one that I think I paid $20 or $30 for, and both of those are 64K machines, not 16K. Although you can probably find an unloved 16K machine cheap if you're interested in upgrading the memory. if it hasn't already been upgraded, because a lot of people, you know, did that upgrade if they bought a 16 early on when price of RAM fell. They did, you know, a RAM upgrade.
The one thing that